Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. You know, had an unusual experience this week, and it reminded me that sometimes the light at the end of the tunnel is a bit of a disappointment. It can be at times. You know, it's very interesting, and this is particularly true in caves. I spent some time this past week in caves. And we are photosynthetic people, aren't we? I mean, that's what we talk about every morning, right? We love photosynthesis. I love photosynthesis. I am so much about photosynthesis. I try to remind you what photosynthesis is about. I try to remind you that our bodies, even though we're incapable of photosynthesis, incapable of it, our bodies depend on photosynthesis. You know what that is, right? It's the thing that it's the reason plants are green. It's the reason it's about that big sun out there that's governing so much of what we do. Gets us especially hot in July and August and September. That big sun and all of the energy that it's turning into mass via plants, and that basically creates the world we know. And we forget about how important photosynthesis is. We are photosynthetic people. I am a photosynthetic person, and yet I gotta say, there's something about this world that is completely ignorant of photosynthesis, that doesn't know green really at all in the way we know green, that has no flowers in the way we know flowers, that has no grass or trees in the way we know grass or trees. This world inside of a cave that is just ignorant of the sun. Ignorant of the sun is an amazing place. So why should we talk about caves on a radio show which is so much about, well, you know, photosynthesis and sunlight and how all that works? Well, I'm going to tell you why. One reason. Alabama, and you may not know this. You probably don't know this. I'll be willing to bet you don't know this. Alabama is the center of cave diversity nationally. It's insane. I mean, you know, we miss everything great about Alabama. I wish we could somehow just capture all of the things in which Alabama is significant globally, and somehow embed those in our hearts and in our minds and in our heads. Because we forget them. We don't know them. We ignore them. Caves. Alabama is the center of cave diversity nationally. It isn't Missouri. It isn't, I don't know, where'd you think it would be? Tennessee? Did you think it would be, I don't know. Where did you think this? But here it is. Here it is. I think Jackson County, Alabama. There's caves all over the state. If you know where to look, if you know what to look for. Particularly in limestone, Red Hills have got caves. Incredible caves. The limestone areas down around Dothan and down around from Escambia County eastward, they have caves. The Red Hills up around Monroe County, caves everywhere. Birmingham's got caves. It's a state that's got caves everywhere, in part because we have so much limestone. But Jackson County, Alabama, is the center of cave diversity nationally. No other county has. Probably no other county has more caves. Certainly, we know that no other county has more cave life, more different types of creatures in caves than Jackson County, Alabama. an amazing thing. Jackson County, up around Scottsboro. East of Huntsville, if Huntsville doesn't pave it over. We hope it won't. An amazing place, an amazing center of cave diversity globally. In fact, here's the, just in the temperate world, there are only really two places that have similar cave diversity. And one is Jackson County, and one's over somewhere in, I think, Turkey or somewhere. It's an amazing thing. And what do I mean by cave diversity? Because, you know, there's all these creatures in caves that they don't know anything about sunlight. Many of them are albinos. They're albino crawfish. Yes. It's cool to see albino crawfish. There are albino fish. There are shrimp in these caves of all types. In the water, because there are rivers in these caves. This is a whole world down there. It's an amazing world. There are flies that only live in caves. I don't know how they do it. It's complete darkness. They only live in caves. There are crickets. There's giant big-legged crickets that only live in caves. They're amazing things. There are salamanders of all types. Many of them only live in caves. There are frogs. They're frogs. It's really interesting. There are frogs that live in caves. There are birds that live in caves. There are bats that live in caves. There are even mammals that live in caves. We saw a nest from one of the biggest, oh, and coolest rats you've ever seen. I love these little rats. We don't even know we're really not sure what species they are. They're pack rats, and they're the size of squirrels. They're amazing, and they're cute as they can be. They're golden. They have these tails that are kind of fuzzy, and these little ears that are so cute. They really are cute. They chew through wires. They chew through anything. They're all about their teeth, like all rats are. They don't reproduce as badly as other rats, and they only live in caves, and they're just as neat as they can be. And they create little middens where they collect all these things from caves. It's amazing, the cave life. And you're in this cave. I was in this cave once. And to understand a cave, you have to understand it as other creatures in the caves understand it. We often bring our sunlight with us in various forms. So I've seen people bring Bic lighters. I've seen people bring flashlights, whatever. And I brought my flashlight. I forgot the rule that says when you go into a cave, always bring two lights. And I'm taking someone who's from Peru or Ecuador into this cave. And we've gotten deep in. We've seen the beaches. There are beaches in this cave where the rivers run through it. And there are beaches with sand. There are beaches with gravel. There are waterfalls. There are all these little beautiful benches, soapstone benches to sit on. It's this incredible thing. And we're way into the cave. We're looking at the fish. And I drop my light. And I drop it into the water. Oh, goodness gracious. And something happens and it goes out. And I'm lost deep in this cave with this person who knows nothing about caves and who is probably much more afraid of what's happening than I am. And I'm scared to death. And you realize this is another world. This is how the world could have been. This is how the world might have evolved. And may one day evolve. It's a whole new way of seeing. There's something about being in that cave. It's cool. It's the temperature is constant. It's this constantly cool 55, 56, 57, 58 degree temperatures. The water, it makes its own rain. The rain is dripping from the ceiling. It's this beautiful, beautiful place. And it is addicting. It's a kind of place you want to know more about. And it's dark, and you realize, oh, man, I may never get out of here. And on that day, I was afraid I wouldn't get out, and I put my hand into the water, plunged it into that cold water that's running, and I scrubbed and I scrubbed and I scrubbed through all the gravel until I found the light at last. Pulled it out of the water. And somehow it turned back on. I think I must have just switched it off or something. I can't figure it out. And we were out of the cave. We went out of the cave. But you know, the closer I got to the light, the more I realized there's something here. There's something more I need to know about here. Seeing that light at the end of the tunnel, it was kind of a disappointment. Hey, we're going to come back. We'll talk a little bit more about caves. We ought to talk about photosynthesis, too. We ought to talk about your gardens. We certainly ought to talk about Alabama and what a special place it is. I hope you realize that. We're going to be back. Give us a call. 251-343-0106.
Everything I got is done and
welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Samson seems sort of sweaty.
Yeah. You know, it's very interesting about caves. It seems foreign to us thinking about caves, and yet Alabama's pride should be its caves. And you know, when we see caves, we think we got to dude them up, right? You know, we got to go in, we got to have all these lights, we got to have a light show, we got to have some weird organ music playing as people walk, you know, all that crazy stuff, and you miss the whole point of the caves. You don't even get to see the cave life, which is so incredible. I mean, the lights destroy the cave life. But caves are cool. They should be the pride of Alabama. We shouldn't be gussing them up with lights and all that kind of junk. They're really cool places. But people have always used these caves. And I want to talk about it just a second. We got a caller, but I want to talk about caves just a second, because they've played a really important role in human history. And we know a lot about Alabama and Alabama people, Alabamians, if you will, because of caves. And the biggest cave art in North America, listen to me, are you listening to this? It's not in New Mexico. It ain't in Missouri. Biggest cave art in North America. And possibly the oldest is in Alabama. It's this massive, massive, massive drawing on the ceiling of a cave, deep in a cave. You can barely stand up in this room. And it covers... It covers like a football field, this drawing. It's immense. And it was made by shamans, by prophets, by whatever you want to call them, the people who had contact with the spirits. It was their communication with the spirits. It was a prayer on the ceiling, if you will. And they let their imaginations go. Because when you're in a cave, you see things differently. You are suddenly disconnected from the world of sunflowers. Oh, God, do I love sunflowers. But suddenly in a cave, you're disconnected from that, and you don't miss it because you think you've gone to a new place where there's new possibilities. And you see the shamans painting this stuff on the ceilings, and they painted these huge mud drawings in Alabama. And we know that in many of these caves, there are these drawings in places so far deep in the cave that most of you would never find them. Could never find them, even if you were cavers. They're really difficult to find. But it's an interesting world, and I know what they're about. You get in that cave, you're in that darkness, you're separated, and you realize, man, this is a new way of thinking. It is. It's a new way of living and thinking and breathing. And it's sort of just, well, in that darkness, in that absolute darkness, when you turn your light out, it opens your eyes. It's a very interesting world. What an interesting world. We should talk about how they did those drawings someday. It's really interesting. Caves, the thing we don't talk about enough in Alabama, I know it's not photosynthetic. I know you can't reproduce it in your garden very well, but they're interesting places. We should talk more about them. Hey, we've got some callers this morning. Rob, I'm going to talk to you about your loquat. Rob, let me just tell you real quickly, plant it now. No reason not. September is a great time for planting. It's a great time for planting. And loquats, there are a few exceptions to that. And we basically, yeah, I mean, among the common things, it's basically citrus. And to some degree, palms. But that's because they like really warm soil to develop their roots. But loquats, they'll do just fine. They got plenty of warm time to develop their roots, and they'll do it. And they'll do it really well. And citrus also need to have a little more meat on their bones. But it's going to do fine. Plant your loquat now. Plant your loquat now. There are so few exceptions that I almost hate to mention them, but I have to because people do plant citrus and people do plant palms. Those are the exceptions. Plant your loquat now. Now, it's a great time. Great time for planting camellias. Great time for planting shrubs of any kind. It's probably one of the ideal times. It may be the best. Bobby Green says, I'll give you this. Bobby Green says it's the ideal time for planting almost any shrub, virtually any shrub, September, October, because there's plenty of warm soil, but the air is beginning to cool down. It's a little easier for things to keep up. It's a great time. You just have to remember to water them a few times. By the end of October, boom. Nature's going to take care of the rest of it, and you're in great shape. Loquat, great time to plant. I have a caller, and I'm listening. Who's calling again? Paul, hey. Is that you?
Morning. Hi, Bill.
How are you?
Hey, Bill. We're doing good. I hope you are.
Yes.
I hadn't talked to you in quite a while. I've been negligent here. Tell me about bay trees. These leaves, after they start growing, get some little bitty brown spots on them. Can you tell me about them or what we can do to get rid of them?
So bay trees, and this is a bay tree like your... Is it like a magnolia bay tree, or is it like a bay tree you're saving the leaves from to cook with?
Yeah, well, this is the one where you save the leaves for, Bill.
Yeah, yeah. So you're going to be cooking with them. I guess it's a Mediterranean bay tree. Yeah, Mediterranean bay trees grow reasonably well here. They are Mediterranean, and which means, you know, that's Italy. Think Italy, think Spain. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking, and you think Northern Africa and California, and you're thinking about areas that are mostly dry.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sometimes are not, they are, as we like to say, a little naive to some fungi. And I have noticed spots on those red bays on occasion. You know, I don't know what you'd do about it. I don't think it'll kill the tree. Have you noticed it losing leaves, or is just the leaves just sort of getting a few spots?
No, I don't think it loses leaves, does it? It doesn't lose leaves. It just
spots up a little bit.
A little more difficult to use to clean up before we dry them.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think that's going to happen. I think that's going to happen with the Mediterranean bay a little bit. You mm-hmm. still should have plenty of leaves. Do all of the leaves get the spots?
Let's see, my lady here. Do all of the leaves get the spots when they grow?
As they age.
The new ones
come out real nice. But
the new ones are fine, but the ones that begin to age, they get those spots.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, you're one of the nice things about bay leaves is that you can certainly pick them and let them dry a little bit and use them for a long time. Mm-hmm. So one, I don't think it'll be worthwhile to try to find a remedy for that fungus, because I can just about guarantee you there isn't one.
Okay.
And but here's what I would do. Look for the times of year. Look for the times of year when you're not going to get that fungus as bad. And I suspect certain times of year, and maybe coming into fall, the fungus will decline a little bit. Maybe one of the better times to collect the leaves may be in October, if you can, if the fungus is less bad then. Or maybe it's going to turn out to be April or May, when we have a dry spell then, when the fungus hasn't. So save your leaves from that time. You know, dried bay leaves are a little more, they actually have a little more potency, if you will, than the green leaves. So, won't hurt to save a few. I'll come back. I'll talk about it a little more after the break, and we'll just talk generally about those bay leaves. So listen in. We'll be back. Thank you. You too.
And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. Feel free to give us a call. You know, we do get more leaf funks, let's call it that, than maybe other places, and in part because of the high humidity, which creates an environment in which leaf funks can occur. So you are going to get more fungal diseases on many leaves here. Most of them are not significant in terms of how the plant operates, at least if the plant does well here. I will tell you that let's just talk about leaf. Let's put leaf funks in context. So when you get something like Indian hawthorn, you know, bless your heart. When you get something like Indian hawthorn, you are going to have foliar, you're going to have leaf diseases just out the, you know. It is going to be crazy. There's no way to stop it. You can worry about it. You can fret about it. And the only time you won't fret about leaf diseases on your Indian hawthorn is when you dig it up and throw it out. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. There are lots of other plants, you'll notice, that don't get those leaf diseases in such a bad way and that don't defoliate. And, you know, go for it. What would you do an Indian hawthorn for anyway, except for the fact that Home Depot says everybody in North America should have Indian hawthorn? You know, you let people dictate to you. You talk about freedom. You talk about, you know, we don't let people tell us what to do. And yes, you do. All the time. All the time. Every time you go to Home Depot, you let Home Depot tell you what to do. You'd have to take the initiative. You'd have to go beyond Home Depot. That's the freedom, is taking things in your own hands, figuring out how to grow your own plants, encouraging local nurseries, working with those local nurseries to get the plants that you want that work well for you, helping them, recognizing that you pay a premium for freedom. Mm-hmm. We started talking about foliar diseases, but that was a good digression. You know, you want freedom, you gotta take it. It's not, you know, Home Depot is not about your freedom. It's you're being told what to do there when you go buy those plants. Don't do that. So what do you do about foliar diseases? You look for plants that don't have foliar diseases. That's one thing, and there's lots of them out there. If a plant like Mediterranean Bay, the bay leaves, Mediterranean Bay, has foliar diseases, you can mostly ignore those diseases because they're probably it's probably going to do okay. Anyway, it just won't look as pretty. You know, here's an interesting thing, and again, how we let other people tell us what to do. In the South, and I will remind you about this, in the South, when you see, David Hubble's going to jump on this in a minute, when you see old recipes, and they talk about bay leaves, and you talk about bay leaves used in cooking, more than likely, almost certainly, in most cases, in the really old recipes, they weren't talking about Mediterranean bay. They were talking about the native bay. And the native bay could have been several different trees. It could have even been, to some degree, sassafras. But mostly it was red bay. Red bay, and there are two kinds of red bay. And they're native to the South. They're native to the Gulf Coast. They're beautiful trees. They grow really well. They had no foliar diseases. They were beautiful, made beautiful leaves. Cooking with those bay leaves, even when they're fresh, gives such a pleasant, pleasant quality. They're less harsh than the bay leaves you buy at the grocery store, which are from some California bay tree, which is really does poorly here. They're less harsh. They're just have a beautiful flavor, and so we miss the native that we miss the flavor of native bay, which was in our early recipes. It was in our gumbos, in many ways. It was in all the things you use bay leaves for, and really a pleasant thing. Unfortunately, we introduced a disease called laurel wilt because we are Typhoid Mary. You remember that? Typhoid Ted, whatever you want it. It's just, that's what we are. We're introducing, we Typhoid Teds, we Typhoid Marys, we're introducing all of these diseases into the South. And it's hurt our native bays, which is too bad because they're beautiful trees. They're great trees. I love them. They're incredible. They're actually much prettier than Mediterranean bays. They have this reddish purple quality. Even a healthy Mediterranean bay, these native bays are so much prettier. The trunks are stunningly beautiful. We probably won't have the big trees anymore, but we will have the sprouts. And it's because the disease doesn't affect it's introduced by an insect that needs a big trunk and that's attracted to big trunks. I think we can still grow that native red bay. So if you get frustrated with the Mediterranean bay, you should try to find the native red bay. It's getting harder to find because we did introduce this disease. But it still grows, and it's still out there. If you go down to, there was a ton of it coming up. Ton of it after the burns down at Point of Pines, down to Codin. And in that area, it's still all along there. It's still in the forest all through the middle of Mobile County. It's just shrubbier now. It's still there. It's a great plant. It's something we should preserve. The ones that survive the red bay wilt will be the next generation. Thank goodness. Let's hope they survive. And because they're such a part of our culinary tradition. That's how we got to where we are with this question about red bay and bay leaves. Sometimes you get a little funk on the leaves. Try to find a season when you're not using, when you're not getting that funk, and use those leaves. Dried Mediterranean bay leaves are great. Native red bay leaves are even better. They are harder to find. We'd have to take life in our own hands. Again, we would have to not accept hand-me-downs from other parts of the country, which is what we do consistently. Consistently in our gardens. We'd have to take it on our own. Long-term process. Something we'd have to think about. Don't know if we're capable of it, but that's how we could fix some of these problems. Is not taking the hand-me-downs, not letting Home Depot tell us what we're going to do. I'm sorry, I don't mean to pick on Home Depot. I really should say Home Depot, Lowe's, Walmart, Tractor Supply. Sorry. They're all out of some office in New Jersey, and there ain't nothing wrong with New Jersey. But they got some accountant up there who says, yeah, you know, this is what the rest of the world's going to grow. We're going to make them grow it. It may not live there, but they'll think it's their fault. Right? It's a sad thing. It's a sad thing. So Jim's asking, and this is a good question. So, bay trees. Let's talk about the word bay for a second. Can we talk about bay? This is getting interesting. I want to talk about caves again, but we're going to talk about the word bay. You know, we don't believe in the second chapter of Genesis, which says we got to go out and name things. So we don't do a very good job of naming things. And we bring our naming thing from England through the English language, where there aren't many names for plants because there aren't many plants in England. Well, there may be a lot of plants, but there ain't many species. Well, there ain't a lot of plants, actually. And so we don't have a lot of good names, and we don't try to invent names because we're lazy. So we give the name bay to lots of plants. And bay basically generally means an evergreen shrub or tree. And so the name was given to lots of plants in the South. Stay with me. Hold on. So if you had a big leaf magnolia, the big evergreen magnolia, that, you know, everybody either loves or complains about, because it's got those big, hard evergreen leaves, the old name for that was bull bay. Bull bay. Because, you know, if you're from the South, if you remember, if you have a Southern memory for those kinds of things, if it was big, it was a bull. If it was big, it was a cow, as big as a cow. So we called cow oak was a name we gave to an oak that had these really big acorns. And the trees, not incidentally, were pretty big too. Cowcumber meant a cucumber magnolia that had particularly big fruits. So big as a bull bay. And then we had sweet bay magnolia. Hold on with me. Sweet bay magnolia had smaller leaves, and the flowers were very sweet, almost lemony. Smaller flowers, sweet bay magnolia, right? But there's that name bay again. And then we had red bay. We had other bays, too. Many of those bays, all of those bays were in one way or another fragrant. And that, I think, is also sort of wrapped up in the idea of bay, is that it's fragrant evergreen leaves. The magnolia leaves are fragrant. They are very bitter, and they're very inappropriate. I don't think I would cook with them. I don't recommend it. They could be medicinal. I think they have other uses, but I wouldn't cook with the magnolia bays. And a lot of the bays that we see in the swamps are sweet bay magnolia. They have the magnolia flowers. But the red bays are different. They're actually in a different... They're all way over. They're not even closely related to magnolias. In fact, you know what a red bay is closely related to? Our native red bay? Was avocados. Avocados. And the one way to tell the difference is that sweet bay will have silver on the bottom of the leaf. I'm going to have to come back, aren't I? We'll be back here in just a minute, and we'll talk about how to tell the difference between the two.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Let's talk about Red Bay real quick. All right, hush up. There we go. Let's talk about Red Bay and Sweet Bay and how to tell the difference. And Red Bay, and David Hubble, I thought he would. David gave me a thumbs up on it, saying red bay is really probably what we were using in a lot of recipes along the Gulf Coast. It just makes sense. It makes perfect sense. So Mediterranean Bay and the Mediterranean Bay of Europe and the Red Bay of the Gulf Coast and much of Alabama are related to some degree, they're all in a family called Laurelaceae, laurel, the laurel family, which includes things like avocados. And avocado leaves are actually used as spice. The leaves are used as spice in many places. I don't think they're as good as some of the other bays, but they're good. I mean, they have a very good flavor. Red bay is really probably the classic. Let me tell you how to tell the difference between if, and we've spread the disease everywhere, and it's having a devastating effect on the red bay trees. You can go into a swamp now or into some of the areas where red bay used to be, and you'll just see thousands of dead stems. It's really sad. And we just, you know, it's like we spread these disease and we can't even see our own mess. It just, you know, oh, I wonder what happened here. Lord have mercy, help us. So we're spreading the disease, and it's had an effect, but they're coming back from sprouts. And in many cases, we're getting back from sprouts. If any place has been burned, which is fine too, they'll come back from sprouts and shrubby. But let me tell you the difference. Sweet bay will have silver on the backs of the leaves. There will be silver on the backs of the sweet bay leaves. They'll be evergreen. They'll be longish. They'll have silvery color on the back of the leaves. Very simple. Red bay will not look silver on the backs of the leaves. And in fact, if you look at it right, I can see why it's called red bay. It has a reddish purplish tone. In the old days, we didn't use the word purple as much, apparently. And a lot of times, purple is sort of a combination of red and blue. And a lot of people see purple as more red or less or more blue, depending on how you look at it. But there's a reddish-blue, purplish cast to the leaves of red bay. But they definitely will not have that silver backing of sweet bay. And they'll have that great fragrance. There's another way to tell red bay, which is really cool. It's really neat. They are the host to a gall that really only lives on red bay trees, and it's a mite. It's an old association. Doesn't really harm the tree in any way. Gives a home to this little mite, but they'll have little knots on the leaves, and they're not, you know, if you like something that looks like it came in a bottle from Walmart, you may not like, you know, you might not like these. And plus, these leaves are going to be too big to put in a bottle, a little Mediterranean bay bottle. But they'll have the little knots on the leaves as well. So red bay, really cool. You can always send me pictures if you have any questions about whether you're looking at red bay. Gosh, I hope there's some still out there. I have a confidence that there is, and that you'll continue to find it, and that we'll continue to figure out how to use it. We need to be, if we don't plant our houses on top of all the remaining populations, which is an even bigger threat than our disease, I hope we'll be able to find red bays that will survive for a next generation because they're resistant to the disease. And I think right now that selection process is already ongoing. It's really neat. Really neat. So red bay, really cool. Some other questions. Jim, let me come back to Jim here real quickly. Jim says, has the wind kicked up prior to storms? That's right. So one of the things you'll know about, to help you to know, sweet bay magnolia, which is not the spice, not the traditional spice, not red bay, but when the wind turns those leaves up, they're very silvery on the backside, and the wind will do it very flash at you with that silver, really kind of cool, silvery white. Lino, good to hear from you. She wants to grow garlic. And this is a good time to talk about it, because, and we talked about it, yes, October is a great time to plant, garlic. October, November, even as late as November. Here's the trouble. You've got to be able to buy it. And right now, garlic has gotten very popular, and I have been writing about garlic for quite a while. And I, you know, sometimes I regret it when people take my advice, because a lot of people can end up taking that advice. And it makes it harder for me to order the things, because the companies don't keep up sometimes. But yes, we have made recommendations. I'm going to tell you, for the Gulf Coast and for Sims, the one type of garlic that does really well consistently, and you got to trust me on this, I'm just going to warn you, are the turban garlics. They're a group of garlics called the turban garlics. And that includes things like Thai fire, Thai purple. You can imagine that a plant, a garlic that grows well in Thailand might grow well here. Chinese purple, blossom. Oh, goodness gracious, folks, what are some of the others that we've recommended? There's several of them out there, but that's the group. You're going to have to find the ones that are still left, because garlic has now begun to sell out. And the turban garlics, which everybody used to ignore, and so I could buy as many of them as I wanted, they finally, people have realized, oh, wow, they do really well. They do really well in the South. Yes, they do, because they're from a climate very similar to us. So turban garlics, and you're going to have to find whichever turban garlics you can find. The garlics that they sell up north do not do well down here. It's one of those hand-me-down ideas, one of those hand-me-downs that, you know, we eat it. We try to deal with it. And even if it doesn't produce for us, we're still going to buy. Don't do that. You want to buy turban garlics that are adapted for the Southeast. Look around. Look for a place that has Chinese purple. Even if they're out, they should have other varieties. Blossom is another name to look for. Chinese purple and blossom. Chinese purple garlic. Blossom garlic. Search on your internet. I think everybody, most of you have access to the internet now. Thai fire, Thai purple. They're mostly going to be sold out, but there'll still be a few left. And when you look, they'll be called turban garlics. And you can look for other turbans that might do well for us here. But there it is. Start earlier next year, because the popularity of these garlics means that they're sold out very early in the year. So we got to think about that. One of the things we have to think about. We're going to be back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106. We're going to have another hour.
She's my pizza pie with lots of mozzarella. With guguza, I want to be. Cause guguza is so crazy over me. Guguza grows in Italy. They love it on the farm. It's something like zucchini flavored with Italian charm. I call my gal
Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast, with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Yeah, there we go. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. We could talk about a lot of fun things today. I've been talking a little bit about caves. That's weird, isn't it? Here we got this show. We talk about plants all the time, and I love plants. You know I do. You know I'm a sucker for. And you know, I think plants are the structure of our world. I mean, they have structured our world in incredible ways. In one sense, plants and photosynthesis, that thing about getting light from the sun, really threatened to destroy the world. And it basically, photosynthesis basically said, okay, I'm going to wipe out everything that doesn't. So we had this oxygen pollution. Yes, sir, indeed. We had oxygen pollution in a major way. Vast oxygen pollution early in the world that killed off a lot of forms of life. I mean, it just basically changed the world, and it was destructive. And what we ended up with was something very new. Very new. And it was about harvesting sunlight, and harvesting sunlight became a very important part of how we structure the world. So plants are the sort of the walls of our world. In many cases, they're the ceiling of our world. They're the roots of our world. They have become our world. And I love that. I think it's incredible. I think that's incredible. And everything else gets its energy from plants. You may think you're a meat eater, but you're really getting your energy from plants. Cows would be useless without plants. They're not very efficient users of plants. They're one of the least efficient users of plants. But we've decided we are going to cost the world by eating lots of cow. So, but it all comes from plants. All comes from plants. There it is. Fish, basically. All of that web is basically mostly about plants, though fish can sometimes, deep sea fish can sometimes have other sources of life that build up their meat and bones. But plants. And then I start talking to you about something that absolutely has almost nothing to do with sunlight, that is completely ignorant of sunlight, the caves. And one of the cool things about Alabama is that not only is it the center of things that are dependent on sunlight, plants. I mean, the center of oak diversity, you know, probably the richest forest ecosystem in North America, the longleaf pine forest, center of magnolia diversity, center of hickory diversity. Mobile County is the center of grass diversity in eastern North America. All these things. It's the center of sunflower diversity globally. Can I go on? Probably the center of trillium diversity. I could go on and on and on about all the things that depend on light, but I want you to remember that there is this other thing that Alabama does really well, which is to support life that lives in caves. We are the center of cave diversity. We are one of the great global centers of cave diversity. We're certainly the center of cave life in North America. That's what we started talking about. And sometimes being in a cave, you realize, boy, this is a different way of seeing the world. This is a different way of imagining the world. You actually, and you're in that 50-degree cave temperatures in the middle of August. It's really amazing. You feel these caves blowing the air out into the forest. It's so cool. Literally. You'll be going by and suddenly, boom, you're in this blast. What in the world happened? It's like October fell into the middle of August. And you realize, oh, there's a cave here. And you back up and you go into the cave and you get into that cool air. And it really, it's the odor of the cave, the darkness of the cave, everything about it, and you realize there are no plants here. But there's all sorts of other life, and they're doing things in a different way, and you go deeper and deeper into the cave, and sometimes you do it without a light, and that's very dangerous. But it gives you a sense of what's happening with this cave. Your eyes adjust to some degree. Don't go in too far, please. And you come back out, and it's kind of a disappointment. I mean, I'm telling you, it's odd. You hit that warm, the going from that cool air in the cave to that suddenly warm air. It's not even like going from the cool air in your house to the warm air. I don't know why it's different. It is so different. But it's like as soon as you leave that the air of the cave, it's like, oh, oh, shoot. It's interesting. There's caves call to you. They call to you, and they should be calling to you even if you love plants. I love plants as much as anybody, but these caves, they're calling to me. And you know, Alabama's the center of it. We need to understand more about caves. We need to understand more about caves. Michael Neal is asking me about wildflowers. He has lots of questions about wildflowers. I don't know if, Michael, did I get to you about the questions about collecting seeds from broom sedge and partridge pea? Partridge pea is just, I mean, it's going at it right now. It is one of the beautiful wildflowers, and it's gregarious, it's aggressive, whatever you want to call it. It's out there right now. It's shouting all over the roadsides that don't get firebombed with herbicides and mowing. It's out there. It's really cool. And the broom sedge is beginning to put up stalks. It's beginning to bloom. It's a little early for both of them. I don't know that I answered this last week. So let me do it now, Michael, before I get to your second question. Yeah, if you're, and it's a great thing to collect the seeds from it. I love partridge pea. It's beautiful to me. I mean, it isn't. I don't need to qualify that. It's beautiful. It doesn't matter. It's beautiful to me. It's beautiful to lots of people. It's a beautiful grass. It's not a grass. It's a wildflower. And it's this foliage that's just delicate. If you don't know what partridge pea looks like, you know we have this thing called internet. You can go look it up. Partridge pea, Camacrista fasciculata is mostly what we have. We sometimes have Camacrista nitens. They're beautiful. And they're going to be producing seed pods. Wait for those seed pods to turn brown. They're gonna hang on the plant for a long time. It's going to be much later in the year, Michael. Late October. Broom sedge is the same way. It's going to be October, November, really before it's ready to pick. And you can go through picking it then. Those flowers hang on pretty well. You want to get it before there's a big wind. But you can look at it, and you'll see they get real fluffy. And if you have any questions about what you're looking at, everybody is always free to send me a picture of those flowers. And we can determine whether we're looking at the right thing. Now, Michael also asked me, is it winter burn or spring burn better for wildflower regeneration? And there is a very simple answer to that. It is very simple. The best time for wildflower burning is when wildflowers happened naturally. There it is. And fire did not naturally occur, because that's what they've been living with for, right, a million gajillion years. We, you know, some of these wildflowers have been around the Southeast. You know, there's probably back even into the Miocene, I suspect. We certainly have evidence of fire back into the Miocene in eastern North America. We know that was managing ecosystems even in the Miocene. Miocene was, you don't know when that was. Let's call it 25 million years ago, if you can comprehend that. That's not as old as the dinosaurs. That was sort of the age of the evolution of mammals. It's when we were getting all these really cool mammals. It's when camels and horses were evolving in southeastern U.S. Yes, the center of evolution for camels and horses, virtually all the world's camels and horses, well, their origins were here in eastern North America, and particularly in the Southeast and Southwest. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about that season of burn. When did it occur? What's the best time? As soon as we get back.
Along about 1825, I left Tennessee very much alive. And I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been a-ruttin' that Tennessee stud.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yep, there we go. Welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It is an Alabama Sunday morning. A lot of questions that we're going to follow up on. I'm going to, let's talk about this season of fire. What is the right season of fire for wildflowers? And, you know, there's several things that go into it. But the question is, how long has this been going on? What causes fires naturally? What caused fires naturally, mostly, was lightning. And we have less lightning and during winter. We also have less times during winter when lightning could actually cause a fire, if you see what I'm saying. And then there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, foliage was wetter. The temperatures are lower. The humidity can decline, but it's possible. But it's winter was not the traditional fire season in the South, and we know this now for lots of reasons. We've gone back and done tree cores. We looked at how plants respond and if plants respond more beneficially to burns in later in the year than in winter. We know, oh, you know, maybe there's a reason for this, right? And maybe it has to do with that's the way things have been for a long time. So what we know is that wildflowers and grasses that are the pitcher plant bogs, all of those, they really respond to fires that occur in late March, April, May, June, sometimes into July. And there's nothing wrong with a July burn. It can really help. Later in the year, it's a little more problematic. Different things happen. I'm not saying we didn't have burns later in the year, but they were probably naturally less common. Less common. And there's good reasons for that. Plants didn't respond as well. They don't respond as well generally, but it can happen, and it can be okay. But basically, there it is, March, April, May is your peak burning season. From March 15 on, along the Gulf Coast, is when you really are going to get the best benefit from it. Now, you may have to make a decision based on a lot of things that you're not going to burn in during the growing season or during spring, as you would like to call it, because actually we're talking about both spring and our early summer, which we can call American summer. Those periods of time, American summer is probably the best time. That is from mid-April into mid-June. But it's all good. Late spring, March 15 on. But you may have to make a decision to burn earlier simply because we live around people and because things have happened to the woods that we have to take it, we have to think about. So if you've got a lot of woody vegetation that you like, if you've got a lot of young pines, you might, that first burn, you might have to be a little considerate about that first burn. If you've got too much fuel, you might want to burn in winter if it hadn't been burned in a long time. All those things, but it is less effective to burn in winter. More effective to burn after the 1st of March, and particularly after March 15th. That's kind of the peak time. Those fires will be more intense. So you need better preparation for them. Winter burns are done because it's easier on... It's easier for people to do, and maybe easier to control them as well. But it's you can control those spring burns, but you need to talk to me if you don't know about what you're going to have to do to control them. And it's I do it all the time, and it's really a lot of it's. I'm not supposed to say this out loud. It's fun. I mean, it's like being in a cave. It's like all the things that you're not supposed to like, and you suddenly realize, God, I really like fire. Maybe there's some ancient history with humans that means fire is kind of something we're built around, and maybe fire is something we're supposed to play a role in, and you get this feel in fire, and it's dangerous, but it's fun. But you have to be very careful. So you call me. Spring's the time. Spring is the time. Spring is the time. March 15 through May 15, which is out of spring. June 15, out of spring. And even into July. But don't ever do a July burn as your first burn. Ever. Ever. Somebody is asking me if we have ramps in Alabama. Oh, man. What a great question. What a great question. So if you don't know what, you know, I'll tell you, and this is no problem. Folks in South Alabama, they don't know what ramps are. And that's okay. That's okay. Ramps is a funny term that probably is related to some word called rampion. A ramp is a native onion relative that is not quite an onion and not quite a garlic. It is something else altogether. It's very sweet. It has a very distinctive taste. It will, as people like to say, you eat it, if you eat it socially, all of you need to eat it. It does produce that wonderful garlicky kind of odor, but very distinctive. I actually like the smell of it on people better than garlic. You know how people smell after they finish an Italian dinner? And I actually like the smell of ramps on people better. We could do a ramp perfume. Ramps are a beautiful plant. They're great for eating. They've become a delicacy now. When I was younger and doing my forestry work in the mountains, only the old timers knew what a ramp was. Now it's become trendy, and you read about it a lot. Does Alabama have ramps? You betcha. What's interesting about Alabama ramps is they're not the same as North Carolina ramps. We now know. We may actually have some of the North Carolina ramp species here, but we have our own, which has wider leaves. They're really distinctive. I think I like the flavor of our ramps better. You know, maybe it's this thing because they're here with us, and maybe I'm not being fair, but they're delicious. They're absolutely delicious. You're only going to find them really in the northern part of the state. I wouldn't have been surprised to find them. I wouldn't have been shocked to have found them even in the Red Hills, and I might believe that it's possible that we might find a ramp somewhere in the Red Hills at some point in our lives, but that's not their really habitat. Their habitat is the Cumberlands, the Cumberland Plateau, and to some degree the Blue Ridge, where it crosses into Alabama at Cheehaw and the Rebeccas. That's where ramps grow, and they are wonderful. They're delicious. I shouldn't tell you this, but long term, I'm thinking about maybe starting a ramp production facility with our southern ramps because they're so good. They're so neat. Yes, ramps do grow here. What a fun thing to talk about. Anybody who's ever eaten ramps can testify to how they are. David Hubble has probably not eaten ramps. It's not a Louisiana kind of thing, though we have other onions that are quite good. And we forget about our native onions and how important they are. Ramps are one of those native onions, not truly an onion, not truly a garlic, kind of something really in between, very distinctive tasting. But all of our native onions are really cool. Jim is describing a grass to me, a ditch at Rabbit Creek. Could be a lot of things right now, but one of the things that's blooming right now, the old timers call it greasy grass. Greasy grass. Can I talk about greasy grass for a minute? It is so cool. It even has an odor. It's a grass with an odor, and you can smell it walking through the field. It produces an oil, and we could come up with pretty names for oils, you know? Oil de Olay or whatever. You know, these beautiful, beautiful, fragrant oils that are produced by this. But, you know, the old-timers, they're just going to call it greasy grass because the grass produces an oil and very fragrant. You can actually touch the flower heads you can feel those oils exuding from that grass. I have no idea why it does that. I don't understand it. Why would it? I don't understand it. It's something but I love purple top. Purple top is the name of the grass probably that you're looking at in your ditch. I'm just guessing. Send me a picture. It's blooming right now. It's blooming all over Alabama. It's one of our great neglected warm season grasses. Purple top. Purple top. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Okay, all right. We'll have other music, so we won't have to wash that out of our brains before the show is over with. And yeah, we're going to have other music. Listen, so we've got some other questions. One of the plants that I've often recommended for people who love wildflowers and who love to see what happens with wildflowers are among our native mints. We talked about our native onions here. And David, yes, Ramp, R-A-M-P. You can look it up, R-A-M-P. And you won't be able to find the Southern Ramp except in a few places, because only recently did people in Alabama start looking and realize, oh, we got it too, and it's different. That's how we are. Way behind. But we're way ahead when it comes to species in Alabama. We've got incredible stuff. Ramp. But one of the other things I recommend was a mint, a native mint. And our native mints are really cool. You know, we always get hand-me-downs. That's right. So our mint juleps are from, you know, they're European hand-me-down mint juleps. But we have a lot. They're made with mints from Asia and Europe. But here's the thing. We got all these incredible native mints. Some of them are too strong, too harsh, just like any would be in any part of the world, for eating easily, but they're all really cool. And some of the native mints have really, really delicious, delicious leaves. Pycnanthemum, there's many names for it. I would like to call it snow mint, frost mint, frosty mint would be a good one. It's a distinctive native mint. Most of the plants, the leaves right below where the flowers emerge, it looks like they're covered in snow. They're really beautiful. And it's sort of a flag that they throw out to attract insects. But the flowers themselves are very fragrant, too. I think that's a big attraction. And the insects just pile onto those flowers. They're very beautiful plants. There are many species in the South. There aren't many in the North. And many species of this pycnanthemum, this hoary mountain mint, they call it. Well, hoary mint's fine. Mountain, there are not many species in the mountains. Most of them are down in the central and coast parts in the coastal plain. It's a really cool plant. And so I recommend it. And I recommend that we look for it in the woods around us, because you're not going to find it, because, you know, people in Michigan, they ain't going to grow what we grow, and we get our stuff from Michigan. You remember, we let other folks tell us what we're going to grow, because we don't do it ourselves. So if you get Pycnanthemum pilosa, as nearly as I can tell, there's not really a plant called Pycnanthemum pilosa, by the way. I think that is Pycnanthemum verticillatum, misnamed by somebody probably in Michigan, or in Connecticut, where the variety pilosa, Pycnanthemum verticillatum pilosa, grows. Any rate, it's probably from Connecticut and Massachusetts, where it has a very narrow range. You let somebody in Connecticut and Maryland, not Maryland, but what is that state? Massachusetts, tell you what it is you could grow, and it's not going to grow well here. Yeah, it's young. It's probably not going to bloom that well this year. You may get blooms yet later, but it is not one of our great native pycnanthemums, and it's probably not going to survive for that long. Look for our native pycnanthemums. Why don't we have people selling seeds of native pycnanthemums? Well, it's because it takes buyers and sellers. And we would have to have a coalition of buyers who would buy it, and we would have to have some smart sellers who knew how to take advantage of those buyers in the best possible way by selling them seeds that will actually grow in their yards. And we have to have producers, people who produce those seeds. I collect my own seeds. for these wildflowers and sow them. My goal is to produce a collection of wildflowers that can be used in certain parts of the state. And we need more people who are doing that. We need more people who are doing that. But there's some great pycnanthems out there. Don't give up on the pycnanthemum just because you got a hand-me-down that's probably not going to do as well here. Don't give up on them. Let's go looking for those pycnanthemums, Bruce. Bruce, let's look for them. Let's try to find them. You send me pictures of them. You're good at this kind of stuff. You find those native pycnanthemums. You send me. Let's talk about them. Let's talk about how they are so easy to start from seed and so easy to grow, and the natives are so cool. I'll also tell you that most of the pycnanthemums are really good from rhizomes. So if you find a good population, just take a little piece on the edge of that. Just take, cut it off at the ground. Don't take the whole plant. You don't need to. Just take a little piece off the edge, and that will spread. They're going to spread, and they're so cool. Send me a picture if you want to know, and we'll try to figure out which one it is. Can be a little tough from pictures sometimes, but we'll try, and I can put you in the right sphere. But if it's growing native and it's a pycnanthemum-looking thing, you're going to be good. It's a beautiful plant. I love it. I love it. I love that you're trying it. I don't know how well that one is going to do. It is probably very, has a very, it's a population that I can tell you because it has the name Pilosa attached to it. It was probably selected in Connecticut. Verticillata, which barely gets into Alabama, the big species, this particular variety is of the species is from really only Connecticut. And it's not going to do that well for us. It's just not going to do that well for us. So there it is. Let's see what else we got. Too many things to contemplate is what we got. So let's see. We've got maybe some of these things were a little people still dealing with pears. Now there's something that's pears. That's something that's easier on the brain. Are there pears that grow well on the Gulf Coast? Can we talk about pears? Because I like pears. There are some great pears out there. Yes, there are some great pears. One of the problems with some of them don't do as well on the Gulf Coast. Kefir does really well. And kefir doesn't start out. Let me just talk about kefir. Because it's a great pear. It is a great pear. And it has a great flavor. And maybe when it's ripe, it's as good as any pear around. It's really one of the great cooking pears. Delicious in torts, tarts, whatever you want to call them. They're beautiful. Kefir needs to be, well, the word's not blooded, but they need to age. They need to ripen. And that's the cool thing. You can pick kefir pears. September now, and you can keep them for months and keep eating on them, and that's one of the really neat things about them and one of the big advantages. But you do need to let them age. They will soften. They are good for all types of things, so don't give up on kefir because it's not listed as a soft pear. That is a pear you can eat straight off the tree. Many of the best pears are eaten after, and apples as well, after they've had a time to age a little bit, some of the best. But yes, there are a lot of great soft pears, and it's a little bit of a challenge to find them because, you know, we get most of our plants as hand-me-downs from other places. The Warren pear is one of the great pears for the South. In fact, Warren pear was selected by a man named T.O. Warren, who I don't know, but I've read about him all my life. I remember reading about T.O. Warren when I was 17 years old. He's over in Hattiesburg. You know where Hattiesburg is? Not too far. We're all part of this. You know, we like to think there's a big dividing line between Mississippi and Alabama. There's not really one. Particularly between East Mississippi and West Alabama. And T.O. Warren's over there in Hattiesburg, and he he found this pear tree, and he was a kind of a fruit expert, a little bit of a sort of a self-made fruit expert. And the Warren pear became one of the, it's considered one of the best pears for eating in the world. It's delicious. It also is one of the best pears for growing in the South because it's very resistant to fire blight, very resistant to diseases. Every place I've grown it, it's very, very productive, very good. The one thing I'll say is that Teal Warren's pear, the Mr. Warren's pear, the Hattiesburg Warren pear, probably needs a little more chilling than it's going to get in Mobile, in mid Mobile. If you were in North Mobile County, I think it would do just fine. And North Baldwin County probably do just fine. Monroe County, it's going to do great. But it's a little warm. It is a little warm for Teal Warren's pear on the Gulf Coast. You can certainly try it. Another place to look for trees like pears that can do well along the Gulf Coast is Just Fruits and Exotics. And they've become, people, you know, I sometimes worry about recommending these places because they sometimes get overshopped. And right now, it looks like Just Fruits and Exotics is getting overshopped. They're having a hard time keeping up, but they're propagating. They're trying to catch up. They have a lot of great pear trees that don't need a lot of chilling. One of those, for example, is the Golden Boy soft pear from Panhandle, Florida. And I have not grown it, but I've heard some good things about it. And you might want to try that one. So check out, they have some other great soft pears, including some of the pears from Southeast Asia. So be thinking about those. Be thinking about those pears. And from the Just Fruits and Exotics website. Just take a look at them. Yeah, the dogs, they heard the coyotes. Sorry. There it is. I got to admit it. So, two old evolutionary pals yelling at each other. But we're fixing to go to break. We're going to be right back. Give us a call.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world alone. There is no sickness, toil, or danger in that fair land to which
I... Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain on my face hasn't stopped raining for days. My world is a flood.
Yeah, let's get back to it. We've got a few minutes left. So give us a call, 251-343-0106. If you've got some questions, we'll have time to squeeze them in. If you still have some questions, I'm trying to make sure I've got to everything that we have. Can you graft store-bought magnolia that blooms a lot to wild volunteer magnolias to make them bloom more? Yes, you could. You know, ultimately, the volunteer magnolias are going to bloom about as much if they're getting an equal amount of shade. The reason they're not blooming is because there's puberty. And I don't know how else to tell you except there's puberty. And a lot of plants take a long time to undergo puberty before they become reproductively active. I just, you know, we got to talk about these things sometimes. And the magnolias that are wild, it's going to take them a while. The ones that are store-bought, they're artificially, in many cases, they're selected for early puberty. In some cases, they're grafted, and in some cases, they are grafted, and so they bloom earlier. It all depends. But yes, if you could graft some of those if you were good at grafting, could you do that? Yes. Is it worthwhile? No. Don't do that. And you would have, you'd have to cut your tree down. That would be the first thing. There's just not much advantage to it. Give your trees a little time. They're going to start blooming. Give them enough sunlight. Don't cut the lower branches, because if you do, you're going to have a maintenance nightmare. And the lower branches are where most of the flowers are prettiest. I mean, you get flowers up in the top of the tree, you're not going to see them. You want the flowers down at the bottom where you can see them and smell them and, you know, pick them to bring inside. Don't cut the lower branches of your wild magnolias. Do I think it's a good idea to have a lot of wild magnolias in your yard? Well, if that's all you want, yes, because that's all you're going to have. There won't be nothing else there. But I think one wild magnolia is kind of a nice thing. Maybe a screen, too. They just take up a lot of space, and you do not want, under any circumstances, to cut those lower branches. Enjoy them. Enjoy them. They're going to bloom. They'll bloom just fine. They're going to bloom really great, but they have to go through puberty first. And, you know, it varies. I don't know. It could be anywhere from 7 to 20 years, depending on circumstances, between the time it's a seedling until it goes through puberty. Kind of like people. Not too different than people. Right? Right? So give it some time. It will flower. It'll flower. Yeah. So got a caller. I'm listening. What's up? Janice?
Hey, you there? Hi, Bill. Yeah, calling from Foley. The question on monarch butterflies. I have milkweed in my yard. I have monarch butterflies. Is it early? Because they've chewed it down to nothing. Actually, I'm driving right now in search of some milkweed because I am almost chewed down to nothing.
Well, a lot of that milkweed will come back. What kind of milkweed was it?
Most of it's tropical. I have a little bit of swamp.
Yeah. Yeah, and the swamp is, okay, good, good. You know, there's some great milkweed out there, Asclepias rubra. Let's talk about these butterflies right now. It's less important that they produce caterpillars right now than that the adults have lots to eat on. The caterpillars will be fine. That's nice. So a wide variety of plants are really good for monarchs. And what we really want on the Gulf Coast is flowers like goldenrods and lots of other plants that are blooming late into the year, because that's when monarchs really need us. They need us most late in the year and early in the year when they come in March. And many monarchs are going to overwinter here along the Gulf Coast. So, one, if things are getting chewed down, if the asclepias, if the milkweeds are getting chewed down this year, that's okay. You actually don't need a lot of caterpillars right now. What you really want are flowers for the adults. There's a lot of concern about using those tropical milkweeds in terms of their potential for spreading disease. I don't really understand what the potential is, but there's, you know, I don't know that there's a good need for using those. But yes, there are some great milkweeds out there. Ideally what we want with a milkweed is the milkweed that is going to feed those caterpillars when they're first waking up in spring. That is our most important role. And unfortunately, those milkweeds are not available because they're all southern milkweeds. They don't even exist up north. People up north have never heard of them, but they were really important traditionally in the milkweed fly path. And what was an interesting thing was they did some work in New York on the monarchs going up there. And what they found was is that the monarchs in New York had in their chemical signature plants that were only found in the longleaf pine ecosystem in the deepest south, and one other one called antelope, which is also a deep south plant. So what that means is that these populations, they need those. They need those as they move up. So, yeah, we do the best we can. I think you're okay. I think it's okay they're being eaten down. We don't need more caterpillars right now. We need to keep the adults healthy. So you're fine. Don't panic about that. Look for Asclepias rubra. It is one of the most beautiful of all the milkweeds. You probably have Asclepias incarnata.
Which one?
Rubra. So Asclepias is the name for milkweeds. It's named after the old doctor, Asclepias. Asclepias rubra, R-U-B-R-A, which sounds like ruby. And there's a reason it sounds like ruby, because it means red. And Asclepias rubra is our swamp milkweed. It grows on the edges of swamps down here. It's even better for us. If you can find it, it's really cool. There are 40 species of milkweeds that grow in the longleaf pine ecosystem. Unbelievable. And there's so many of them that are really great early in the year. And if we could grow those, they're really great. And there are probably others, but look for Asclepias rubra next year to add to your collection, and move away from that tropical milkweed, which there's a little bit of concern about it. Does that help?
Sort of. But meanwhile, I have like 14 caterpillars in a caterpillar cage, and I'm running out of. I've chewed everything down to zero, so very hungry caterpillars. So I will grow for next year. But meanwhile, I'm trying to keep them going for this year. Okay, next question.
Yeah, and boy, call me back next week. We got to take it. We are taking the big break. We'll be back next week. Good to hear from you all. If it keeps on raining.